holding on Yud Amud Aleph about two-thirds of the way down the Amud. We're holding the line begins now. So just to recap what we had talked about after the two dogs. The Mishnah had mentioned that one of the Goyish festivals, when we're not allowed to do business with them, on that day, 3 days before, whatever it was called, Yom Ginusia, the day of Ginusia of their king. So we started discussing what that means. First, we said it meant the day that they crown a new king. Problem is, we have a Braisa that mentions them separately, the day of Ginusia and the day that they crown their king. So then we started saying, okay, maybe one of those means the day they crown the king himself, and the other one means when they crown his son as his successor while he's still alive, which sometimes they do that. Sometimes they would want to do that in order to confirm that the son is going to be the next legitimate king. The problem with that is that we said that the Romans, the Pasuk called Edom, which that's who the Romans descend from, the Pasuk calls them Kotin Nisaticha Bagoyim, I made you small among the nations, Bozri Atamoid, you're very degraded. And we said the meaning of Kotin Nisaticha Bagoyim is that they don't have a hereditary kingship, they don't have kings who are the sons of their parents. So therefore, each time it's somebody else, whoever grabs power or whoever they elect or whatever it is, which shows therefore like they don't have people who they train to begin with for the kingship.
If I have a question, if he made them so small, how come they had reached a huge empire?
They made a huge empire because
for hundreds of years.
That's the point. In other words, even though fine, they ended up having a huge empire, but in origin they were a very small, unimportant nation. We're talking about the Romans, and the only reason they became great and powerful is because we did the wrong thing, and therefore Hashem gave them the power. Therefore Hashem gave them this power to become a world empire and destroy them. Why them and not others? Because for one thing, because they're Esav, they're the brother of Yaakov, whatever. The point is, and then we said that Bozri Atamoid means they have no language and script of their own, which we discussed yesterday, a couple of possible meanings of that. Either it means, Rashi says, the Rashi that we have in front of us is that they got their language and their script from elsewhere, and I go to Tzionim on the side, it brings from Rashi and Ein Yaakov, that it means that the Christian scriptures came to them from others, from Jews, who wrote them for them. And then Tosfos talks about an idea that it means that they don't have a royal language and script of their own, as many other countries do, where the kings and the noblemen or whatever have a unique language of their own, not the same as the common people language. Anyway, by the way, Ben Yehoyada points out that you have three things that we're saying that the Romans don't have. They don't have Melech and Melech, or Mem. They don't have Ksav, and they don't have Loshen. Those three things together stand for the word Melech, Mem, Lamed, Chaf. Symbolizing, therefore, that their Malchus is, in a certain sense, not a real Malchus. Anyway, going back to Melech, Loshen, and Ksav, right. So getting back to, so we can't say that Yom Ginusia means, and the day that they appoint a king, means one of them is talking about when they appoint the king himself, and the other one when they crown his son as king, because they don't crown their sons as king. They have, and Hilda. Yeah, historically, by the way, I mean, throughout most of the period of the Roman Empire, they usually didn't. The Gemara is going to mention soon, actually, there are exceptions, but for the most part, usually, each emperor is either he seized power from the previous one, or each one would adopt "quote unquote" his successor, and then they confirm a successor, whatever it is. They usually didn't have that their biological son is the next king. Okay, so we can't say that. Ela mayim genusio yem halayda. So we have. Okay. Yeah. Fine. Okay. Fine. So we have to say then, what does yem genusio mean? It means the day. It means the birthday. It means the birthday of the king then. Okay, well then again, the question is, Valtani and Ginusia Vemalaida, where we have another Braisa that says the day of Ginusia and the birthday, again, meaning that Ginusia is not the same thing. The answer is, L'kasha hodi day hodi bray. Okay, there you can answer that we're talking about the birthday of the king himself, and you're talking about the birthday of his oldest son, fine, or his son, whatever. Fine, even if his son is not going to be the next king, still, they'd make a celebration in honor that he has a son. But we learn in yet another Braisa. Actually, Tosfos says not necessarily another Braisa. The Gemara was quoting different pieces of the Braisa. Now we're putting it all together. But the Braisa says, you have four different kinds of chagas. The ginusia of the king himself, the ginusia of his son, the birthday of his, and the birthday of his son. So therefore implying that Ginusia is not a birthday, and you can't say, therefore, that it means, so therefore, of necessity, you would have to say that it means the day he's appointed king, but we just said that on a point, So no, after all, you have to say, like, our original understanding was correct, Yom Ginusia means the day that they appoint a new king. Veloikasha, and then it's not a contradiction why we're saying the day of Gnosia and the day they appoint a king, because, as we said before, Veloikasha ha-didei ha-dibrei, one is the king himself, one is his son. Now you're wondering, as we asked before, that we just said the Romans do not have hereditary kings. They don't appoint a king the son of a king. Right. And by the way, as we mentioned yesterday, even we find in the kings of Edom at the end of Parashas Vayishlach also, none of them were the sons of their predecessors. So it goes back a long way among the Romans like that. You look in Parashas Vayishlach over there. You have the first one, the second one, whatever. You have Vayomos this one, Vayimlech that one. It never says Vayomos, Vayimlech, whatever. Each one is from a different place. One is from Masreka, one is from Ruchavis Anahar, one is from this one.
Why don't we mention the fact that they had, most of them had illegitimate children?
This is also true, but that's neither here nor there. That's the point. The point still remains, regardless whether their children were legitimate or illegitimate. Either way, in general, they didn't succeed them. However, the Gemara says, Al Yidei She'eila Moikmi. However, based on a special request, if they get special permission from the Senate, then they could have a hereditary king. As we have the example of Asvirus, the son of Antoninus, where Antoninus asked for permission to have his son succeed him, and that in fact happened. So here the Gemara is going to get into, we're going to have a number of stories involving Antoninus and Rebbe. A huge amount of ink has been spilled on which of the known Roman emperors is Antoninus. Because there were half a dozen of them, beginning in the middle of the second century, there were half a dozen of them or more that had the name Antoninus as part of their name. You had Antoninus Pius, and you had Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, and you had something Antoninus something or whatever, I forget all the names or whatever. So you have a huge amount of ink has been spilled on which one is the Antoninus that we're talking about over here, the friend of Rebbe.
Can we date?
We don't know for sure. Partly it depends on when we date Rebbe. Partly it depends on when we date that Rebbe lived and when he wrote the Mishnah. You have two major approaches on it. One is that Rebbe wrote the Mishnah around the year 500 L'shtaris, as we're talking about Shtaris, the last couple of days, which would come out to the year, it would come out to the year 3948 or 49, whatever, since creation. It would come out to about the year 190 or so CE. Another approach is that it was about 30 years later, about 530 L'shtaris, about 219 CE. So based on that, you have two different understandings. Which one would have been, if you say the first date, then more likely the Antoninus, who was the friend of Rebbe, is the one who is known in Roman history as Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. He was emperor for about 20 years, 19 years, whatever. He's known to have been a philosopher. He's known to have been, so therefore that kind of fits some of the things the Gemara tells us about him.
Reasonably good emperor.
He's considered one of the good emperors. One of the biggest things historians have against him actually is that he had his son succeed him as emperor. If he's the Antoninus of our Gemara over here, his son turned out to be a no good Nick, basically. As a lot of historians date the beginning of the decline of the Roman Empire to that. Anyway, if it's him, then that's him. If not, then there was another one a couple of decades later who also had the name Antoninus in his name and also had his son succeed him. So yeah, there are possibilities here. So
that's the code,
we're going to quote that. Antoninus and Rebbe, that's Kinei Goyim of Itnet. We're going to quote that later on Yudah. Rashi just says about Antoninus. He doesn't specify any more than the Argamara does. Yeah. Okay. What happened? Amalei Antoninus.
So how long after the Roman conquest was that?
So this is if you're talking Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, so he became emperor in the year 161. So it's long after the 26 years. You're talking well over 200 years later. You're talking like 250, 270 years after that. So yeah, they dominated out Israel during a good part of the second Beis Hamikdash. Then the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. Now, about 90 years after the Churban, is when this Marcus Aurelius Antoninus became emperor. Again, if you say it's the later one, then it's even later. Whatever. Okay. Anyway, so Demolach, so this Asvirus about Antoninus, in fact, ruled as king. How did it happen? Amalei Antoninus to Rebbe. Antoninus says to Rebbe, but in the Yimlech Asvirus Brit Chosi, I want that my son Asvirus should succeed me as king. And also I want that his added Tveria Klanya, I also want that Tveria, the city in Eretz Yisrael, should become a free city that should not have to pay taxes. And the reason for that is, Rashi says, because many of the Chachamim lived there. Rebbe himself didn't live in Tveria per se, but he lived in that area. He lived in Tzipori, whatever. That's the point. In other words, he wants. He was a friend of Rebbe, as we're going to say later. He was very close to Rebbe. Therefore, he wanted to give the Tveria Chachamim a break, and then they shouldn't have to pay taxes. They wanted that it should become klanya, that it should become free of taxes. The problem is, Antoninus says, now, if I ask the Senate, the Roman Senate, to do one of these things, Abdi, they'll be willing to do it. Today, like Abdi, but to do two things beyond outside of the normal things, that my son should succeed me and to make Tiberia free of taxes, they're not going to do both of them. So what should I do? So instead of answering him directly, I see Gavra. So Rebbe took one person out of Achavre. He made him ride on the other one's shoulders. He took two people and had one of them ride on the other one's shoulders.
I got the point.
So he takes one person, puts him on another person's shoulders. He gives the upper one, the one who's on top, he gives him a dove. Then Rebbe goes over and says to the one below, tell the guy who's on your shoulders to let the dove free and it should fly free. But he didn't actually say what he meant, but Antoninus got the hint. Omar, so Antoninus realized, Shmamina, I can see from this, Hachikamali, what Rebbe is hinting to me is as follows. At boy minayu das virus briyim les tchoisi, you ask them that your son at virus should succeed you. The emolai las virus, it is determined to very klanya. Then tell at virus, like he'll be the person riding on your shoulders, you tell him to let the bird free, to let Tiberia be free of taxes. So that way, you'll get both things accomplished. So this way, you'll get both things accomplished.
After he died.
Okay. Another example, another time when Antoninus had to ask.
Maybe feasible, but what about if the son doesn't want to?
If he doesn't want to, okay. But he'll tell his son, this is an important instruction I want of you. I did you a favor. I got the Senate to agree to make you emperor, which you would never have by yourself. Especially again, if it really was this Commodus known from Roman history, who was known to be a no good nick, then they never would have confirmed him on their own. They only did it as a special favor to Aurelius. So yeah, okay. Anyway, okay. Amalei. So now another time. Here's another example where Antoninus had to ask Rebbe for advice about how to run the government. He says, "Mitzavimli chashuri remoi." He says the Roman nobles, the Senate, whoever it is, are causing me a lot of trouble. I'm having a hard time getting them to do what I want. So again, Rebbe didn't want to tell him outright what to do. Instead, he hinted, for reasons that the Gemara is going to say on our days. So instead, Rebbe took Antoninus into the garden. And every day, he'd bring him into the garden, and he'd pull one radish out of the bed of radishes, out of the ground, in front of him. So every day, he's pulling one out. Omar, so Antoninus, got the hint. I see that what Rebbe is hinting to me is, get rid of them, kill them off one at a time, rather than trying to fight against all of them, eliminate them one by one, and that way they won't realize what's going on, and they won't think to rise up against you, the same way as you're pulling out the radishes one at a time from the ground. That's why he didn't want to say explicitly. Why, by the way, is he comparing to radishes? Because a radish has its head stuck in the ground and its leaves up above. So the same way, like these guys have their heads down over there thinking of plots against you, so therefore, yeah.
One of them,
you know, you find some excuse that he did this, or, you know, he did this or that or whatever, treason or whatever, and you get rid of him, and then, you know, and then 6 months later or whatever, you do with another one, and after a while, you have the dangerous ones are eliminated without anybody realizing.
Rebbe was so faithful.
The lame lay maim of the head, yeah? So why doesn't Rebbe say it outright to Antoninus? The answer is Amar, because he said Shami bichashuvir emoyu mitzarulay, because then the Roman nobles themselves may get wind of this and then they'll cause him trouble, meaning Rebbe. Okay, the question is Lemele blachash, fine. So why didn't he just tell it to Antoninus in a whisper?
The answer is because you have a prophet that says over Shemayin Yehovah Hazakol. You have a prophet that says even the birds of the heavens can carry the sound. In other words, somehow or other, it might end up getting heard.
It could even be we're talking about, I think, Ben Yehuda says we're talking maybe the Mazolos or whatever, the Mazolos even, whatever. They could do astrology and whatever and find it out. So therefore, better to not say it out.
Fine. The walls
have ears. Yeah. The walls have ears, yeah. Okay. Here's another example where Antoninus needed advice from Rebbe, and again, Rebbe didn't tell it to him outright.
Antoninus had a daughter named Gila. Avdi Isura, and she committed an Isur, which usually in Gemara terminology, when we say Isur or Avera, without specifying, it means, you know, threat. Shodala Gaidira. So Rebbe sent to, sent to Rebbe an herb named Gaidira. Gaidira in American English, we call it arugula. You can find it, arugula. You can find it in the grocery. You can find it at a green grocer. They use it nowadays in the garnish or whatever. Anyway, the point is, what is Gaidira?
Rebbe, when Rebbe gets it, he's real wise. Why is Antonina sending me this herb? He broke it down. Gar gira, gar meloshim garar, dragged along, schlepped along. Gira is, he knows, is the name of Antoninus' daughter. So therefore, in other words, Rebbe caught the hint that he's telling me that Gira has been dragged along, has been pulled along to go together with people who are committing niyush.
Yes, it's Aramaic name. Okay, so Rebbe spoke Aramaic, and apparently Antoninus knew enough of the language also. Yes, apparently, yes. Rashi says to me, Yajaya, how you live with Antoninus. Antoninus knew how to learn, yes. Okay. He knew how to learn, yes. We'll see. Okay. Christians have a slightly different explanation. That the Aramaic word for adultery is dire. Dire of the Gayarta is a Noyafane office, so therefore, Gayar Gira means literally, it means much more directly that Gira has committed adultery.
Shodol like Kusbarta. So Rebbe sent him back an herb called Kusbarta.
In English it's called coriander or cilantro. That's very appropriate to the parasha. The Rashi mentioned that the comparison, the mon
was shaped, it was little round balls like coriander seeds. Anyway, so he sent him Kusbarta. So Rashi understands. So Rashi explains the word Kusbarta can also be broken down into two Aramaic words. Kus means shech, and brata means daughter. So shech the daughter, kill her. Shodolei kauti, so then Antoninus sends Rebbe a kauti, which is a leek, meaning kauti moshen kores. Do you want my descendants to be cut off?
Apparently at that point he didn't have a son. Sholachlei chasa, so Rebbe sent him in return a chasa, lettuce, chasa moshen chot, habrachmanos. Okay, in that case then I take it back, habrachmanos. Tosfos learns a little differently. You got to ask him, what is Rebbe thinking the first time? He knew that Antoninus was only child, so why in the first place did he tell him to kill him? So Tosfos says that no.
When Rebbe sent him Kusbarta, the first part, Kus,
is actually the Russian Kisu, the Russian cover it up. And he goes, yeah, go ahead and give it to her, but it's private. Don't make a public thing out of it.
Antoninus is the one who misunderstood that it meant Shechter, kill her. And so he's asking Kauti. And when Rebbe answers with Chasa, he's not saying I changed my mind. He's saying you misunderstood me the first time. When I sent you Kusbarta, I meant the kind of Kusbarta that involves Chasa, that involves having Rachmanis on it.
In the first explanation of the word was?
The last explanation was you killed her, and then afterwards, when it was Kusbarta, Kurs is the Arabic word for Shech. More about Antoninus and Rebbe. Kol Yoyma have a Shogalay, Dava Pricha, the Matar. Yeah, that's it. Cop off means to kill. Means to kill. Kois means specifically the chef. Same way as an answer to the word. Kol Yoma have a shovel like Yahav a Tzich of a Matrosa. Every day or every so often, Rebbe, Antoninus would send Rebbe
pieces of gold.
Not gold coins, in other words, but broken up pieces of gold. The Matrosa in big bags and big sacks.
The chiti, akumayu, with wheat on top of it. So this way, if anybody opens the sack on the way, they'll think it's a sack full of wheat. They're not going to realize there's gold in there.
I guess it weighs more. I don't know. So maybe he'd add in other things so it doesn't weigh as much. I have no idea. Amalehu, and he would tell the people, I'm to you chiti, the Rebbe, go bring this wheat to them. Amalehu, Rebbe, like to them. The Rebbe says, I don't need it. It's the tshuva. I have plenty of it. The Rebbe was, we now have total dhuva from Akumayu. That would be very weird. So I don't need the gold. Omar, so Antoninus answers him, whatever will man the Basra, let him go, if not for you need them, let them be for the ones who come after you, meaning your descendants, the Yahadi, the Basroi, the also Basra, who are going to eventually give it to the ones who come after me,
who are going to go after the ones who come after you. In other words, Antoninus is saying, you and I, Rebbe, are friends. I'm not exacting taxes from you Jewish people, but we both know that eventually there's going to be later Roman emperors who are not going to be so nice to the Jewish people. They're going to be demanding exorbitant taxes from the Jewish people. So therefore, better you should have this in advance, so this way eventually they'll have what to pay.
How does that have to come from Matsugoi? And Rabbi didn't foresee that.
Rabbi didn't. I don't know. Okay. Uta osiminayu nipakalayu. In this way, what comes from them will this way, what comes from them will be taken out for them. Again, they'll be able to spend it on bribing and whatever the Roman emperor is. Actually, Marshall says actually another nuance in it. Marshall says another nuance in what Antoninus is saying. Ultimately, uta osiminayu. Eventually, what comes from your descendants to my successors, nipakalayu, eventually is going to be taken out and brought back to the Jewish people. Because when Mashiach comes, as the Gemara says, the Romans are going to be bringing huge piles of presents to Mashiach. So for right now, I'm giving this to you so that your descendants have what to bribe my successors and pay taxes and whatever. But don't think that it's always going to be that way. You know, you and I both know that eventually Mashiach is going to come and it's all going to be returning to you anyway. Okay. More about Antoninus and Rebbe. What do you mean? Where did it say that? Marshall says that.
He had a cave
that went from his house, from his palace, to the house of Rebbe, so he could secretly go there and learn Torah. Now, the obvious question, and the Alshech asked the question, Antoninus is living in Rome. Rebbe is living in Eretz Yisrael. There's, what, 1,500 miles between them? They have a 1,500-mile-long tunnel. So the Alshech says, actually, there is a city, besides the famous city of Roimi, which is Rome, there is also a city of that name in Eretz Yisrael. When Antoninus would come to Eretz Yisrael, he would stay in that city. Maybe it was Caesarea, maybe it was near Sipori, whatever it is. And therefore, they had a tunnel between that and Rebbe's house in Sipori or Beis Yisrael, so that he could come secretly to learn from Rebbe. This way, everybody doesn't see. So this way, he could come secretly and meet with Rebbe and learn Torah from him whenever he wanted. Kol yom have a mighty trei abdi. So every day when Antoninus would come to go to Rebbe's house through this tunnel, he would bring along two slaves. Chad, now I know you're going to have questions, so hold up. Chad katle above the bay Rebbe. One he would kill near the entrance of Rebbe's house, but chad katle above the bay, and the other one he would kill near the gate, near the entrance of his house. Now, why did he do that?
So first we have to ask why he did that. Second of all, we ask how could he do that?
So why he did that? Because he doesn't want that anybody like this. He has to go with servants because an important person like an emperor doesn't go anywhere on his own. He has to go accompanied by servants. On the other hand, he doesn't want them to give away the secret. So now, how does he go? Tosfos asks over here. How is he going and just killing people? Even goyim are not allowed. It's one of the shevamets of Menayach are not allowed to kill people. So Tosfos says, first of all, he's concerned that they're going to tell the nobles, they're going to tell the senate or whatever, and that'll cause me trouble. They'll end up killing me. It's in self-defense, basically. Also, Tosfos says that what he would do is he would pick people who anyway are chayiv nisa. He'd pick people who are minim or mesodos or whatever, people who anyway are chayiv nisa for things that they did to the Jewish people. And Marshall says somewhat similarly that he would take people who anyway chayiv nisa for one reason or another, who were rebelling against the emperor or whatever, for example, a goy is chayiv nisa for avodah zarah, a goy is chayiv nisa for gezel, any of the shevamets of Nenayah. So therefore, you can take anybody who was chayiv one of these things, and therefore that's it. On the other hand, with all that said, the Maharal learns that it doesn't mean that he literally killed them. It means the Maharal uses an expression like he did a higher kind of misa. He doesn't elaborate what that means, but apparently either the Gemara means in some kind of ruchniistic sense, or although that's a little hard to understand based on the next piece that we're going to have over here, or it means that like he put them in a coma or whatever. He stunned them so that when they wake up, they won't know what happened, but he didn't actually kill them.
And every day they didn't notice that people got killed every time they go into
it. Again, the Romans, life was cheap. You had so many people as it is who are going and being sent to the arenas and whatever anyway that a couple of extra criminals here and there, they wouldn't notice the difference. Okay.
In fact, by the way, Marshall said, the verse is, you leave one of them by the entrance of his palace, of the door, the way over there. You take the other one with him along with him. Remember, when he left Debbie, then they dispose of the one he brought with him, and then on the way back, he disposed of the other one.
That way, neither of them sees the other, again, for the reason before. You don't want that the two of them should gang up against him.
I'm assuming he killed himself, so another he didn't have a...
Obviously, that would be the idea, yeah. Omalei, so Antoninus says to Rebbe, the idna da'asina, when I come to you, the idna da'asina, l'nash l'nishkach gvar kamach, I do not want to find anybody else by you, I want it to be just between you and me that I'm here. Well, Yom Echad Ashkei Lo Chanina Bahama Dehava Yosef. One day, Antoninus walks in and he finds Rav Chanina Bahama, one of Rabbi Talmidim, sitting over there. Omar, Antoninus says, Lo Yaminu Lach Beidna Dasinu Le Nashka Vakamach. Didn't I say that when I come, I don't want anybody to be here, any person to be here? Amalei, Rabbi answers him, Late day Bar Inish. This is not a human being. This Rav Chanina Bahama is on the level of a Malach. So he's not included in your rule. Amalei, Santanina says, okay, Amalei lahu abda de goni abava, fine, if you're really a malach, if you're such a great person, then fine, go tell that servant who's sleeping by the entrance, d'koyim b'leisei, that he should get up and come. So, also Chanina b'chama ashkechei d'havak til, he goes and finds the guy's not just sleeping, he's dead. Or according to the Maharal, he's stunned, whatever it is, yeah.
The guard,
yeah. Amalei, Santanina, Chanina b'chama, so thinking to himself, Hey, so now what should I do? I have a problem. By the way, Tosfos points out, by the way, over here, there was a Girsa Im Kane, that if so, that Antoninus tells him, then go wake him, the guy up. Obviously, that's not the Girsa, and in fact, we don't have that in the Gemara, because if Antoninus is saying that, then Rav Chanina should already realize there's something unusual going on over here. So there's no Im Kane. It's just, go out of here. I'm still fine. You may be a Mala. Go out of here. Go do a service for me. Go wake up that guy.
Did he see an old Girsa Antoninus?
Well, not Antoninus. No, Antoninus himself knew what the situation was. Rav Chanina Bahama didn't realize yet. That's the point. In other words, that's Tosfos' point. Is Rav Chanina, when Antoninus tells him, go wake up this guy, he doesn't realize that he's actually dead or stunned as far as he knows. Okay, there's a guy sleeping over there. Antoninus says, fine, but Rav Chanina Bahama comes there. Almost, and now he says, hey, Chievit, so now what should I do? He ezel ve'emalei dekotil. If I go tell Antoninus that the guy is dead, that he's killed, you're not supposed to. Ein meshivin al kokala. You're not supposed to come back giving bad news. He sent me to wake him up, and I'm supposed to be. I can't just tell. It's not derech eretz to go tell him he's dead. Eshpeke ve'ezel. Should I just leave him and go away? Komazal zulim lachosi. Can't do that either. That would be disrespecting the king. He gave me a job to do, and I have to come back and report. So what do I do? Bar rach mi'alei ba'achyei v'shadrei. So he davened for rachmanos for him and was mechayef in him and sent him off. Omar, so now when he comes back saying, Antoninus, I found this guy dead, but it's okay because Antoninus says, Yodaina, okay, you know what, Rebbe, I know Zuti de Isbahu Machayim Mesim, even the smallest among you are able to be Machayim Mesim. Look, not only you, Rebbe, yourself, but even your Talmud, Rav Chanina, is able to be Machayim Mesim. Mihu, however, nevertheless,
very nice, but the Asino and Nashkaf in his come off. In the future, whenever I come, I don't want anybody else to be here. Let's not take chances like that again.
It went okay this time, but let's not take our chances in the future.
Well, by the way, when he made him live again or resuscitated him, we don't know that he could have told that Rebbe was with Antoninus.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he had like a temporary amnesia of what retrograde amnesia of what happened in those 2 minutes. I don't know.
Okay, no, that's what Rebbe meant. In other words, Rebbe didn't mean. Yeah, but that's the point. So yeah,
he didn't believe.
Okay. This expression, by the way, Zutu de Isbro Machayim Esim. There's an expression that's brought in a number of places in Chassidus about this. That going back to the times of the Alter Rebbe, that they said about the Chassidim of the Alter Rebbe that were saying have the ability also to be Machayim Esim. In what sense? We have the brain is a very cold, dead thing. It's not alive to Elikos. It's not alive. It's not dead, obviously, but it's cold. It's cold and dead to Elikos ordinarily, whereas the heart is warm and pulsing. Chassidim have the ability, based on what we got from the Rebbeim, to be Mechayim Esim, to take the warmth of the Av of Yira of the heart and bring them and transplant them into the brain, and they run up to be Mechayim Esim in the brain.
I hope I'm not making a mistake. That there's some kind of a kabbal from the Vilna Gaon that anybody gets mentioned in the Gemara.
That's true. Tosfos, by the way, over here mentions a little bit of the backstory of Antoninus. This is the famous story that when Rebbe was born, there was a gzera in effect not to make a bris milah. So that nevertheless, they made a bris milah. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and his wife, nevertheless, of course, made a bris milah for him. So now, when they're ordered to come to the emperor and they're going to get punished, So yeah, this is, it's a very famous story that the that Rebbe's mother was friendly with a noble Roman family, so they agreed to switch babies temporarily. So so the Rebbe's mother takes the baby Antoninus and brings him, who is of course a goyish kid, he doesn't have a bris milah. So when they bring him to court, sure enough, there's no bris milah, and the guy who mastered on them, of course, is now in deep trouble because he obviously lied then. The point is though, and then they went and re-exchanged the babies. The point, and then in fact, the Tosfos brings from that medrash that there's a guy who had mastered on them. Some, I don't understand. I personally saw them making a bris milah. Obviously, their God makes nisim for them, and the gzeira was canceled. The result of it is, anyway, because there was that period of time when Antoninus nursed from Rebbe's mother, that he drank, therefore, milk from her milk, a Jewish woman, therefore, that gave him the skus that later on he was able to learn Torah, as we're saying over here, and eventually that he became a ger. The Yerushalmi actually has that mentioned over there, the Yerushalmi in Megillah, that mentions that there's different, it's not so certain that he became a ger. There are things that seem to indicate that he did and things that seem to indicate that he didn't, but there is strong reason to believe that he was either Nisgayer or came very close.
Why not? They're going to learn Torah Chayim.
Well, but even so, you can teach him the parts of Torah that are relevant to him. When we're saying that Rebbe learned Torah with him, doesn't necessarily mean the whole thing. It could just be, you know, the parts that are relevant. So any time whenever
which parts you can teach to a guy, we talked about when we learned about the Sanhedrin, we talked about that maybe the Mominus, according to the opinion of an Amban, that they have to follow the Mominus of the Torah.
Kol Yoma have a Mashamish Lerebi.
Every day, whenever Antoninus would visit Rebbe, he would serve Rebbe. Machalei, he would bring him food, Masculei, he would bring him drinks. Yes. Now, obviously, Rebbe's own food, and it was huge to be Rebbe's waiter. If you have a boy, Rebbe would make that for Korea, and even when Rebbe wants to climb up onto his bed, have a guck in time of Korea, then Antoninus would kneel down over there on the floor in front of the bed, almost like Saki Laboy Laporia, climb up on me and go up onto your bed.
Omar, so Rebbe says, Lava Erhalos, those little machos are kalai. It's not that heretic to treat to treat a king like you so in such a degrading way. Omar, so Antoninus answers, never mind that. Mi yisimeni matza tachtecha lo olam haba. Halavai, I should have the schus to be the bed, to be the couch underneath you in olam haba. In other words, that I should even have the schus to serve you in olam haba, so let me at least have the schus now. Omale, so another time, Antoninus says to Rebbe, asinu l'alma da'asi.
Am I going to come to olam haba? So this is, by the way, one of the possibilities that maybe he didn't become a ger, because if he did, obviously there's no question. So, but this could also be before he became a ger. If we're saying he became a ger, it was definitely at the end of his life. So it could have been before that. Anyway, Amalek came. So Rebbe said, yes, you will come to Olam Haba.
If he converted, why did you say?
If he converted, then of course, because of course, he every year, Kol Yisrael, Hashem Chayel Olam Haba, then what's he asking? But if he is, if
he killed people.
No, but the Gerishin is got cotton chanel, Tommy, right? I mean, you have, if we talked about in Sanhedrin, if you have a case where a goy committed an Aveira where he's chayav Misa, that he's still giving the same Misa after, and this time there's no Misa based in any way, it's long after the Chur. Okay. Amalei Ein. So Rebbe says, yes, you will come.
Amalei, not in a sense, why not? Well, you have the base Asa. The prophet says there won't be any remnants of the house of Asa.
Doesn't that include me? So he answers, but Osa Maisa Esav. That only applies to somebody who acts like Esav did. Somebody like you who does not act like Esav did is not included in that.
So he's not part of
it. In fact, we learn like that in the Maisa. When the Pasuk says, well, you started the base Esav, there won't be any remnant of the house of Esav, it's an Ebadiah, it's an Aftarah, Parshas Vayishlach, appropriately enough. Yochol Lako, you would think it means a blanket statement. Nobody from Esav is getting through. Tamalim Levesa Esav, therefore the Pasuk says, to the house of Esav, meaning Ba'osa Maisa Esav, only if he acts like a member of the family of Esav, only if he acts like Esav. Then Amalei, so Antoninus continues to Rebbe, V'hoksiv, but you have a Pasuk in Yechezkel,
you have a half a chapter in Yechezkel over there where he describes how all the various Goyish nations are going to be sent down into Gehenna. He just starts by describing how Pare and all those armies are going to wind up
down there, the Pare of his times, that is, and when he comes down to over there, he's going to find already Asher and Babel and this nation and that nation and whatever. So that, and the Pasuk says, Shama Edom Lachel v'chomasiyah. There is Edom, her kings and all her princes. So according to that, I'm the king of Edom, so what does that mean for me? Amalei, so Rebbe says, but that's why it says Malachel, like Kol Malachel.
Yes, but it says her kings. It doesn't say all of her kings. And it says Kol Masi'eha, all her princes, meaning Kol Sarah, not necessarily all the normal men.
So who who are the Nesi'im over here? Tosfos brings over here that the Nesi'im are the consuls. So now, in Roman history, in brief, they had originally, when the Romans originally set themselves up as a city, they had kings for 200 odd years. Eventually, later on, you had one of their kings raped a woman or took her by force or whatever. So then, at that point, the Romans decided we don't want kings anymore. They kicked them out. That was the end of the kingship. They set up the consulship every year from then on. They have, Tosfos describes over here, they have one old man with 300 advisors. So they actually had two Roman consuls, but maybe the point is because usually you had one of them was in Rome and one of them was all fighting elsewhere. So in Rome itself, you had one, and then you had the Senate as advisors to him. Eventually you had Julius Caesar took things over by force.
Can we apply the to Beis Israel? We said Goyim, Esav, Beis Esav, didn't belong to that because he didn't act like Esav. Can we say the same thing about Jews who don't?
No, because a Yid has a Nefesh HaLekis regardless. So no matter what, Adam Shachat is Yisrael. No matter how low it falls, it's still Yisrael. We talked about in Sanhedrin. There may be ways one way or other in which you can actually manage to squeeze into my boss, even if he can't, even if his body and his nephew Bahamas are completely corrupt, then fine, his neshama can still go into a new body. He can still be nisgalgal into a new body and have chesed basim and have Mashiach time and have Mashiach time. Okay. So anyway, so Tosfos explains over here that Nesi'eha refers to the consuls. So then we're saying call Nesi'eha, because apparently there was no exception among all of them, but among the Malachim there is an exception. And among the Sareha, as we're saying, there's also an exception. Among its princes, meaning its senators, there's also an exception. Tani Nami Hachi, in fact, we learn like that in Abdaisa. Malacheha, v'lai kol malacheha. Malacheha means but not all its kings. There are exceptions, such as Antoninus. Kol Nesi'eha, v'lai kol Sareha. It says all of its Nesi'im, all of its consuls, but not all of its Sareha, all of its senators, because those, again, there are exceptions. Malacheha, v'lai kol malacheha, prap Antoninus ben Aphirus. Antoninus is an exception. He's not in Gehenna because he was apparently. Kol Nesi'eha, v'lai kol Sareha. When we say all of its Nesi'im, all of its consuls, but not all of its senators, prap k'tiyah bar sholem. That comes to exclude k'tiyah bar sholem, who is not in Gehenna with the rest of them. Who is k'tiyah bar sholem? K'tiyah bar sholem ma'avi. What's the story with him? So like this. There was a certain emperor who hated the Jewish people. Not very descriptive. There were a lot of them like that. But in particular, there was one where this story happened. The one time he says to the important people of the kingdom, the senators or his advisors or whoever, he asks them about this. Imagine a person has a nima, like a growth. A dangerous growth on his foot. Rashi says actually not a growth, but this bottom mess, dead flesh, causing him trouble. Eventually, it causes gangrene, causes all kinds of complications. What should he do? Should he cut it off and then he'll go on living, or should he leave it and he'll keep on having trouble from it? So they say to him, obviously, you should cut it off and you should live. Meaning, in other words,
it meant cutting off the whole
thing. No, not necessarily. It depends how big the growth is, but whatever. The point is that the nimshol that this emperor meant is the Jewish people are like our foreign body by us. They're like dead flesh compared in within our empire, so we should be getting rid of them. So K'tiyah bar sholem, one of the senators or whoever it is, one of the advisors, speaks up and he says to them, no. You can't. You're not going to be able to. Number one, don't do it because you're anyway not going to be able to kill all of them. And the Gemara quotes a pasuk for Pashtus K'tiyah bar sholem when he's discussing with them. Is not quoting this pasuk. The Gemara is quoting that pasuk to support his statement. K'tiyah, as the pasuk says, Ki k'avar ruchas hashemayim peirachti eschem. Could be he was quoting the pasuk. I mean, they had the Tanakh had been translated by that time. The intelligentsia knew of it. So maybe. Anyway, the pasuk says, Hashem says, I've scattered you like the four winds of heaven. You have to ask my comma, what do you mean? Does it just mean that the Jewish people have been scattered in all directions, to the four directions? What do you mean, what do you mean like the four winds? It should say to the four winds. Ella, no, over here, the word ruchos doesn't mean directions, it means winds in the sense of the north wind, the south wind, etc. Kishemshi, Epshala Olam, below ruchos, just as the world cannot continue to exist without the winds, Kach Epshala Olam, below Yisrael, so also the world cannot exist without the Jewish people. So therefore, you anyway, even if you try it, you're never going to be able to kill all the Jewish people. But Oid, and besides that, Ketir Bar Shalom says, Korolach Machot Ketir.
People are going to call you, everybody in the world is going to call you a cut-off kingdom, like a kingdom that doesn't deserve a murderous genocide or whatever, but also, in other words, a kingdom that's missing something essential.
A kingdom needs Jews in order to be an important kingdom. By the way, you see that throughout history. You have that any major kingdom that had Jews in it prospered, and then when the Jews left it, then it became a nothing, Spain being an excellent example of it. But there are many others.
So the emperor says, "Name the Shabbos Muhammad." Okay, you have a very good point. You said something true. Mihu, however, now you're in trouble because you spoke against the king. Call the Zaki Malka. Anybody who defeats the king in an argument,
Shadulayla Kmunya Chalila will be thrown into a hollow Kmunya. Rashi describes that a Kmunya is a building full of dirt. In other words, they'll throw him in there where it's full of dirt, and he'll suffocate. He'll be buried alive in there, basically.
Can they accept his opinion and then criticize and then punish him?
Okay, so one idea is, like Maharal talks about, that in this case, I mean, obviously the king usually wants his advisors to speak up and tell him when something is not a good idea. But in this case, it's like the king had already made up his mind. He's only asking what the right way to go about it. So therefore, he feels that Ketir Bar Shalom has spoken up out of turn to actually tell him it's not going to work.
The same thing.
Yeah, this is also true.
Okay. When you had an opinion different from them.
It's true.
Okay.
Kan have a knock in Leva Adlin, so as they were grabbing the, and by the way, I mean Ketir Bar Shalom, on the surface of it, that's his name, you know, not which in that case, some of the Mephoshim say, obviously it must mean that we know that parents have a degree of Ruach HaKodesh when they name their children. Evidently, that applies to Goyish parents as well, because this guy's a Goy, and yet they thought of giving him a name, not necessarily, I mean, Ketir is not necessarily his original, it would be a translation of his Roman name or whatever, but the point is that they had the idea to give him such a name. And it's appropriate because Ketir, because we're talking about Yikta Enna, the emperor was proposing to cut off the Jewish people, he says, you'll be a Mahusa Ketir, you'll be a cut-off kingdom. Yeah. And we'll see on the next line another reason why he's called Ketir. Kadaver Nachtin Leva Aslin, so as they were grabbing him and going to carry out the sentence, Omrele Ipi Matunissa, a certain matron, a certain Roman lady, says to him, Vilele Ilfa to Oslo Beloy Michsa, woe to the ship that's going without paying the toll. In other words, she's saying to him, look at this, you're being killed for your defense of the Jewish people, but look at this, you haven't paid the tax, you haven't paid the toll, you haven't gotten yourself a bris milah that you should at least have a share with them in Olam Haba, in their Olam Haba. Nofal al reisha de orla sekata. Sure enough, he fell on the end of his orla and cut it off. He took out a knife or whatever and then cut it off and made himself a bris milah right there on the spot. Omar, he says, Yehovah's Michsi, Chalpis Vavris. Okay, now I've paid my toll, now I've passed along, and now I can come. Now I can come into Gan Eden with the Jewish people. There is, by the way, there is a good deal of discussion about this. I mean, on the face of it, this is not a complete gerus, among other things, because he didn't have tevila, but at least Marsha points out, based on a Gemara in Erevin, we have the famous thing that Avraham Avinu sits by the door of Gehenim, and anybody who doesn't have a bris milah, he won't allow him in. He'll tell him he has to go to Gan Eden. So therefore, of necessity, this guy comes there without a bris milah. Okay, he's not a full-fledged Jew, he didn't undergo full gerus. But nevertheless, he doesn't have an orla, so therefore he doesn't belong in Gehenim anymore.
Did you know that
I don't know if he knew that halacha, but whatever. The point is that this way, at least he accomplished that. They talk about also how b'chlal. I mean, we know we're going to learn in the next parak. Actually, we're going to learn that a milah performed by a goy is not a valid milah. So how is this a valid milah if he himself is a goy? One of the interesting answers is based on the same idea as we learned back in Gittin, I think it was, that an eved can receive his get shichrur and gitte v'yode v'yin kachod. The same moment in which he receives the get is the same moment in which he becomes a free person and has the ability to acquire something with his hand. Therefore, by the same logic over here, this guy, the same moment when he's doing the bris milah is the same moment when he's on his way to becoming a yid, and therefore it can be an effective bris milah in that sense. Yeah, it can be like a get shekel. When they were finally carrying out the sentence and actually throwing him into this building full of dirt,
Omar, he says, I want all my property to go to Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues. So how does that mean? How do we divide it up? Who gets what percentage? Yotzer Rabbi Akiva v'dorash, so Rabbi Akiva went out and darshan, as the Pasuk says, by the Lachem Aponim, v'hoisa, actually, la'aron l'bonav, it says that it goes to Aaron and his sons, and what it means is mechta la'aron and mechta l'bonav, it means because it mentions Aaron separately and his children, therefore it means Aaron gets half, and his sons, meaning all the Kohenim, so you know, the Aaron meaning the Kohen Gadol gets half, and all the other Kohenim get the other half. So the same way over here, since he mentioned me separately, and then the other chaverim collectively, it means the half of it is meant for me, and the other half for everybody else collectively. We learned a similar thing in Rabbi Basra. You have a similar thing over there where somebody says, "I want all my nechassim to go to Pliny and everybody else." So it means half goes to Pliny and half goes to everybody else. Yeah.
As opposed to Rabbi Akiva saying,
"I will
split it evenly."
Yotz Abasko v'Omer K'tiyah Bar-Sholem. A Basko came out and said that K'tiyah Bar-Sholem is ready and prepared for the life of Olam Haba. Bacha Rebbe v'Omer. So Rebbe cried about this. Rebbe wasn't necessarily living at the time. This is the Basko's many years later when Rebbe was telling over the story. He cried and he said, "Yesh Kona Olam B'Shah Achas." There you see. You have a person like this K'tiyah Bar-Sholem who can acquire his whole world of Olam Haba in one moment. And then you have somebody who takes many years to acquire his world. So why is he crying? So one reason is Marsha says because he's crying over the fact, look at this. K'tiyah Bar-Sholem only had in one moment he accomplished so much. And imagine if he had lived longer, or imagine if he had been accomplishing throughout his whole life. Imagine what a much greater Gan Eden he would have had. So therefore he's crying over that missed opportunity, in other words, that he only had what you could get the Shah Akas as opposed to what he could have accomplished with that same level for many years. There's other explanations as well, including another explanation is also that Rebbe is crying about it because now it means it puts everybody else. It means that everybody else has a great responsibility. You see that a person can accomplish it even b'shal achas, even in a short amount of time, then that creates now a responsibility on everybody else to do the same kind of thing. Especially, by the way, there's a chassidish explanation from the Mezuzah Maggid that Shah means turning from Lashon Vayisha Hashem al Hevel. Hashem turned and paid attention to Hevel. So yesh kodelam of shah achas, by one turning, a person turns away from one kind of mentality, from rishus, and turns to another direction, already that he's with that, he's kodelam.
I heard some specific explanation that Rabbi cried on Rabbi Elazar ben Dodai.
That's later on your dying, yeah.
But why did he cry? Because he gets the next world without mitzvahs or without...
Yeah, something like that. So we'll have later on in your dying. We'll talk about it there. There is Rabbi Levick, the Rebbe's father, has a deep, fascinating explanation of the Kabbalah of this whole story. There's a lot that goes into it, and there's way too much to be able to excerpt. But one thing he points out, the Seichat Dvarim, is, so what do you have over here? You have K'tiyah Bar-Sholem, and you have this Matan Nisa, who between the two of them accomplishes that a Bris Milah is done. He says they are the Gilgal of Zimri and Cosby. From the story of Baal Pa'ur over there. There you have Zimri went with Cosby and they defiled his Bris Milah. Here you have the other way around. The K'tiyah Bar-Sholem made up for what Zimri did over there in the Matan Nisa, representing Cosby as the one who gave him the advice to do that. Yeah. And he goes into detail over there.
That's Jewish.
Yeah, okay. So like this, his neshama came back as this guy who eventually, yeah. But
the neshama come back into a guy?
It can happen. It can happen even when neshama comes back into an animal. Yeah, it can happen when neshama comes back.
Neshama into
yeah.
An animal?
Yeah, I think I've once told a story before that's told briefly in the Sefer Shevet Yehuda about somebody that has that is neshama is misgalgal in a bull, which is supposed to be used for a bullfight, and instead his father comes to him in a cholim and then tells him you have to arrange that bull shouldn't be used for a bullfight, but rather that it should be shechted and the meat given to poor people, b'nei Torah or whatever, and the son manages to accomplish that, and that way he's misakin his father's neshama. Okay. Most are actually rather. I read it as a story when I was a child many many years ago. But the basics of the story, they're there. They made it into a whole arichos, you know, kiyad hakosev atova, you know, as people come up with to make it into a nice sounding story. And Shevet Moser, it's told in like two lines. Anyway. Also, he points out over there that the emperor over here. He's saying the Jewish people are like dead flesh because he's arguing like they're dead in the world, as opposed to K'tiyah Bar-Sholem explains to him that just the opposite, they're what makes the world keep on living, like the winds, etc. Yeah. A whole long article. Who this emperor was, by the way, made people think.
Hi there, Charles. Many people think that the emperor in this story might have been the Emperor Domitian. Historically, it's known Domitian was second. He was known to be very cruel to the Goyim as well, but also to the Jews. And he was the second son of Asclepius. He was the second son of Vespasian. He was the emperor after Titus. And in particular, it's known that during his time there was at least one senator who actually was arrested and executed for becoming a Jew. So that sort of fits with the story over here about Tia Bashal. Okay. Anyway. Going back to Antoninus Shamshe the Rebbe. Antoninus, as we said before, used to serve Rebbe. And by the way, I forgot to mention also, Reb Leibich points out in that whole piece over there, he points out the gematria of the name Antoninus is the same as the gematria of the name of the word Rebbe Yehuda, showing the close connection between them. So Antoninus served Rebbe. Adarchan Shamshe the Rab. And Adarchan, who Rashi says was another Goyish minister, served Rab. Some people say that Adarchan is actually might have been one of the kings of Persia in that time. In other places the Gemara and the Josh and whatever mention a king named Artavon, which historically there's no there was a Persian king of that period named Artavon. So Adarchan could be a variation of that, whatever. So Kishoch of Antoninus Omer Rebbe Nisparda Chavila. So when Antoninus died, Rebbe said the Chavila, the group has broken up. And the same way, when Adarchan died, Rab also said the group has broken up. Why is he saying that? So Rashi says it just means that our love, that we were tied, that we were bound soul to soul, has now been broken. Because now he's dead and I'm still alive. Different proportion talk about the idea also that what it means is, even in Gan Eden, we're not necessarily going to be on the same level again. Fine, Antoninus may go into Gan Eden, as we discussed before. If we say he didn't become a Ger, if he did, then that's different. But if he remained a Goy, then he'll have some level of Gan Eden, but nowhere near the level of Rebbe. Same thing with Adarchan and Rav. In that sense, it's like a permanent separation once we're dead. The Maral also says a word on it that also what they meant, what each of them meant, Rebbe and Rav, they meant that up until now we have a close friendship between the leader of the Jewish world and the leader of the Goyish world, and that helps the world in general. Now that's been broken, and you're not going to have a bond like that again. You're not going to have a close bond like that in the future. Again. I don't know, never happen again, but at least you're not going to have it anytime soon. Tosfos brings, by the way, over here a connection. So we just mentioned by Ketiah Bar Sholem that he had to have a bris milah to go into Gan Eden. So what about Antoninus? So Rebbe brings from that same Yerushalmi we were reporting before that one time, we mentioned before the different things that show maybe Antoninus became a ger, one he didn't. One story that indicates that he did is that Antoninus one time asks Rebbe, when it comes to Mashiach's time, will you give me some of the Leviathan deeds? So Rebbe says, sure. So Antoninus says, why? What's the logic? If there was still a Kohen Pesach nowadays, you wouldn't be able to give it.
Any promising with that Antoninus being a
Hold on, listen. So Antoninus asked Rebbe, I don't understand. If there's a Kohen Pesach, you wouldn't give it to me. But the Leviathan you say you can give me? And Rebbe says, okay, listen, the Leviathan, that's up to Hashem. That's Hashem decides who's going to be their loss of lover. You, we said, are going to be, because you're not going to Maisa Esav, so fine, you'll be entitled to eat from the Leviathan. The Kohen Pesach, look, the Pesach says that an oral is not allowed to eat from the Kohen Pesach, period. There's no getting around that. So Antoninus went ahead and made himself a Bris Milah. So that shows that Antoninus became a Ger. So there you go. Also, in order to get into Olam Haba, he had to have a Bris Milah.
But it doesn't mean that it would be
okay, maybe a Ruchni is a thing, but still, on some level, whatever it is, it means that there's something that can be described as eating.
So he did convert.
So that's what I'm saying. The Yerushalmi mentions over there different possibilities, whether he actually converted or whether not. And besides, because the Yerushalmi's not sure about it, but it could also be, even from the story over here, it could mean that he had a Bris Milah, but he didn't necessarily have Tevilah. Without Tevilah, you don't have a full Geirus. You need Milah and you need Tevilah. So he may not have had Tevilah. The Yerushalmi brings in that connection that if we're going to accept Gerim L'Asid Lavoi, then Antoninus will be at the head of all of them. He'll be first in line. So that might show that he didn't actually become a Ger during his lifetime, and therefore he'll have to. Normally we don't accept Gerim L'Asid Lavoi, but if we say we will, then we'll make an exception for him. Fine, the Yerushalmi mentions over there that if the Gemara says over there, Im boim Gerim L'Moisa Mashiach, if Gerim will come, L'Moisa Mashiach. So I don't know whether that means if we're going to accept Gerim, or maybe what it means is if Gerim will also receive a schar, but it's hard to say that. Of course Gerim are going to receive. get us kindly
Mashiach. Once Mashiach is here, we want to accept them.
Right.
But before
so maybe it means right before Mashiach comes.
Then they will be accepted.
Yeah, because it says, you know, there's a special tzchiyah basin for the exceptional tzaddikim and whatever before Mashiach comes. So maybe then Antoninus would come alive by that one, and maybe.
Makamu means they can't become a gear, no?
Right, but on the other hand, first of all, the Yerushalmi doesn't have to agree with Babli on that, right?
Okay.
I'm saying, so the Yerushalmi doesn't spell it out. The Yerushalmi just says, Im Boyim Gerim La'asid Lavi. So what does that mean? Does it mean that we're asking whether we'll accept Gerim La'asid Lavi? Maybe yes, maybe not. Or does it mean, if Gerim come to receive a reward, La'asid Lavi? In other words, or like a Chelik in Eretz Yisrael or whatever, yeah. Okay, it's not so clear. Another story involving Gerim, Unculus by Cloinimus, Igayer, Unculus, the son of Cloinicus, whatever, became a Ger. Elsewhere, the Gemara talks about that he was the nephew of one of the Roman emperors, either some people say Titus, some people say Adrianus. Anyway, he became a Ger. Shodder Kesa Gunda Duremori Abasre. So the Kesa, the emperor, sent a group of Roman soldiers to go and arrest him. Well, what happened was Unkelos got them interested in Psukim. He was explaining Psukim to them about the greatness of the Jewish people. He got it, so they all became Gerim. Now, how do you do that? Aren't we supposed to try to discourage people from becoming Gerim? One of the answers is that a Ger himself is allowed to try and make other people to become Gerim. He himself being a Ger, maybe he has a heaven. Maybe there's some of Persian want to say that. I don't know if that's accepted. Okay. Hodder Shodder Gunder Yachrina Basre. So the emperor sends another unit of soldiers after him. Amalu, and he tells them before they go, like Tamer Levelay Midi, don't get involved in any conversations and don't say anything to him. In other words, if he tells you I want to explain to you an interesting pasuk, just say no, as the expression goes. Kiyav Shakovalu, so when after they took him and they were getting ready to go, Amalahu, he says to them, okay, I'm not going to tell you Psukim because I know he said you're not supposed to. Emachum Milsa Ba'alma, I want to tell you an interesting thing I just realized. Nipura Noket Nura Kame Pipura. When you have who carries a torch or a candle in front of somebody else in the darkness, the Nipura, which is a low level, carries a torch for the Apifura, which is the next higher level. Pifura la duksa. The pifura does it for the duke. Duksa la hegmoina. The duke does it for the hegmoin. Hegmoina la koima. The hegmoin does it for the koima. These are different levels of nobility, one higher than the other. Koima mean nokat nuri mikami in chief. But would the koima, which is the king, Rashi says, would he carry a torch for the ordinary people? Amri le loy. So they said to him, of course not. Someone, no, you always have somebody lower than the emperor who carries the torch for him. Amalahu, but he says to them, but you should know, by us it's different. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Nokat Nura Kamei Yisrael. Hashem carried a torch in front of the Jewish people. Yichdev, as it says in the Pasuk, in this past week's parashah, Hashem Ha'olech Lefnei Yoyim HaBogayim. Hashem went before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. They were very... Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah. Igayu Kulu, so they were all very impressed by that and they became gay. You can imagine, by the way, I mean, they lived their whole life emperor is God or whatever, you know, and everybody's below him, so to have something like this, that Hashem is, you know, turned over the whole worldview, yeah. So the emperor tries a third time with a third unit of soldiers. Amalu, he says to them, let you show me the body. They don't have any conversation with him at all, period. He's too good a talker. Ki nakti le v'azi, so as they were grabbing him and going out the door, he noticed the mezuzah that was on the doorpost, and he put his hand on it. This is where we get the minhag, by the way, of putting our hand on the mezuzah before we go in and out of a room. And then we kiss it because to show the kedusha of the mezuzah. Actually, Rabbi Akiva Eger brings an interesting point, which he says it's not so simple. If the mezuzah is not in the case, maybe you shouldn't be doing that. Same way as you're not supposed to touch the parchment of the Sefer Torah directly, maybe you shouldn't be touching the parchment of the mezuzah directly. Nowadays, they're always in cases, so it's kind of a moot point. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so for Amalahu Maihai, and he says to them, so what do you think this is? Amrulay Emelana. So now they couldn't hold back. Okay, the emperor said we shouldn't talk, but they were curious too. Okay, we don't know. You tell us what this is. Amalahu, he says like this. Minhagish al olam, the usual way it is in the world, melach batav adam yoshev b'vnim, the human king of flesh and blood sits on the inside of the palace, va'avot of mashamim reitzim b'machutz, and his servants watch and guard him from the outside.
But Hashem isn't like that. His servants sit on the inside, and he guards them from the outside. With the mezuzah. It says Hashem will guard you going out and you going in from now and forever. They were very impressed. They also became geirim. Tula Shadabatra, they ever didn't send any more soldiers because he didn't want to lose his whole army at this point. Okay, going back yet again to Antoninus and Rebbe, the Pasuk says, you were mentioning this before, and Parshas told us, that when Rivka is pregnant, she's having a very difficult pregnancy, she goes, she asks where she gets the nevuah, she hears from the, from Shame or whoever, she hears a nevuah, there are two goyim in your, two nations in your womb. Omer of Yodam Rav, I'll teach you goyim ele geyim. Don't read it as goyim, but rather geyim, meaning proud ones. And it's actually, it's not even an al-tikri, it's actually a kriyu ksiv in the Pasuk. The ksiv in the Pasuk is geyim with two yuds.
It's a vav.
Right. Meaning that the first vav is written in the Torah as a yuds. Ze Antoninus for Rebbe, this geyim therefore refers specifically to Antoninus and Rebbe, who one is descended from Esav and the other one from Yaakov. They're never ceased from their table. There never was not to be found on their table. Not chazeres, lettuce, but like kishus, and kishus is cucumbers, but like tznoin, and not radishes. Not during the summer, not during the winter. They always had these vegetables available. In that sense, they're game. They're like proud. They're on a high level. Well, Antoninus is less of a chiddush, but the point is that because of the point, Rebbe also.
In that time,
the Tosfos actually says what it is the point is Tosfos says they had many people at their table. They had, as the Gemara is going to say soon, that these vegetables are good for digestion. So they needed a lot of these things at their table in order that everybody should be able to eat them and digest their food properly. The chiddush is, even though some of these are seasonal vegetables, I mean, nowadays, look, you can go buy them anytime in the store. But in those times, it was a very rare thing to be able to have these kinds of things any time during the year.
And the Romans mainly ate meat.
Well, there was that, but also they ate vegetables. But yeah, like this, that they had these vegetables all the time, yeah. Domamar, as in fact we find that a Braita says, what's the good of these vegetables? Snoin machatech oifel, radishes help cut up the food in your stomach. Chazeret machatech meichel, lettuce turns it over, so digested better. Kishus marchet meayim, and cucumbers make the stomach bigger. They give it more capacity. Okay, so the question is, Kishus is cucumbers. The question is, didn't a braisa of the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel say that why are they called kishurin, kishurin meloshin kosher, because there was hard, there was harsh for the body as swords, so then they're not good for you. The answer is, it depends. One's talking about small ones, unripe ones. The other one is talking about big, ripe ones. So the small ones are no good for you. The big ones are good. Or maybe it means small and big. Maybe it means small ones like Kirby's and then big ones like the regular size cucumbers. Whatever. No, we're talking about the size, the original size of it when it grew. We're not talking about swallowing them whole. Come on.
But that's what we seem to be talking about.
How would you know which is Ravi and Zuki, which is the problem, which is not? Rashi doesn't say.
That's true. Rashi doesn't say. But pashtus, usually, with most kinds of vegetables, the unripe ones are the no good. Well, actually, no. In the Kotei Rashi over here on the side, it says no, that Rashi brings from Rashi in Brachas the other way around. The small ones are good for you, and the big ones are bad for you. Again, it doesn't mean you eat them whole, but even the big ones, even you cut them up. But I guess, I don't know, they who knows, maybe they develop different chemicals in them. I don't know. I'm not a food scientist. I did see an interesting word from a mayor from Schlaner. He says on it like this. So you have, there's snoin. Snoin means radishes, but it's also Meloshin sina, Meloshin coldness. So therefore, it represents the idea that a person has to have a certain coldness to taivus of this world. Chazeres is Meloshin returning, which therefore means taking the sparks of Kedusha in our world and returning them to Kedusha. Normally a person has, when they're younger, they're very much into eating and drinking or whatever. So it's easy to do the chazeres. It's much harder to do the tznoin, to have a coldness towards the taivus of this world. When a person gets older, it's the other way around. It's much easier to have a coldness because you don't have much of an appetite anyway, but then it's much harder to accomplish the beer of sparks of the Kedusha. What we're saying that Rebbe and Antoninus were able to accomplish is they had it both in the summer of their lives and the winter of their lives, meaning both when they were young and they were old, they were able to have the proper
and the proper balance of that, to be able to raise up sparks of Kedusha and at the same time to have a coldness towards the Taivas of this world. And in fact, the Gemara mentions in Ksubas that before Rebbe passed away, he lifted up his fingers and said that I never had Hanaf in this world, even Ketzbaktana, even as an amount of my little finger. Because even though he had all these rich foods and everything on his table, he himself was very careful with what he ate and with the amount he ate and drank.
Do we know that from other sources?
We know from that Gemara and Ksubas.
You mentioned before that the meaning of putting the animal in the food when you go in and out.
Yeah.
Who pointed that out? He said someone.
I don't know the first place, but I know it's brought in Lechet Yosher for one thing. It's brought in Lechet Yosher that his Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Isterlin, used to do that. And I think he mentions this Gemara in that connection. If he doesn't, then later it's mentioned. I'm pretty sure it's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. I think it's not in Shulchan Aruch, then in Neis Kalim, whatever. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I think so. Okay, getting back now to our Mishnah. The Mishnah had said Yom HaLeid of Yom HaMisa. The Mishnah had said that the birthday and the Yortzeit of the king are considered national holidays for the Goyim, and therefore we're not allowed to do business with them. And we said Rameir had said a blanket statement, Yom HaMisa, and the Chachamim said it depends whether there's Sreifa done by it. Sreifa meaning either we said that they burn his personal items, as the Gemara is going to talk about soon, or the Yerushalmi said it means they burn Ketoros in his honor, which obviously means that they're deifying him, that they're trying to make him into a Getchka. So the mayor doesn't make that distinction. So McCloud, the mayor saw a loishna misa sheyesh b'sreipa, loishna misa she'ein b'sreipa. It seems that the mayor is saying there's no distinction whether they do sreipa or whether they don't do sreipa. Palchim v'alaver is chachamim. Either way, it's an occasion when they worship Avodah Zarah. Alma. So what do we see from that? Sreipa lav chukas. We see from that then that the mayor holds that the burning in and of itself is not considered a chuk of the goyim. It's not considered chukas a goyim.
So
in and of itself, it's not Avodah Zarah, but the very fact that they have at the funeral, they bring korbanos and whatever to their getchkin, makes it a time of Avodah Zarah. But he holds the sreifa is not in and of itself a ritual of the goyim. Miklal did Abbanon Sadri Sreifa Chukai. Evidently, then, that would mean that Abbanon, since they're distinguishing whether they're Sreifa or not.
He doesn't, then Abbanon has to hold the
order. Right, well, that and also the fact that they're Abbanon themselves are saying only when there's Sreifa is there Avodah Zarah, implying that they consider Sreifa itself to be a ritual of the Goyim, of the idol worshippers. The problem with that is, V'hatanya, but don't we learn in a Braisa? We are allowed to do that kind of burning, not of Torahs, obviously, we mean of their personal items. You're allowed to do that burning for Jewish kings. It's not considered Darchei HaMori. It's not considered the superstitious ways of the Goyim, which then would be Osir. It's not considered. Part of the Torah tells us you're not to follow in the ways of the Amorim and follow their superstitions and their Avodah Zarah customs and whatever.
You're allowed to burn?
At a Jewish king's funeral, you're allowed to burn his items. It's not considered to be Darchei HaMori to do that. That's not, you're not over on Darchei HaMori. Now, the problem with that is V'chukahi. If it is a ritual that they do, they have a regular ritual whenever an important king dies, they do this. And how are we allowed to do that for our kings? The Pasuk says you shouldn't go in their ways. Now, Tosfos actually has some discussion over here that there are actually, Tosfos ends up saying, there are two different kinds of chukah, there are two kinds of chukahs of the goy. Because we talked, for example, in Sanhedrin, we say that we have machlokas over there, how you do the mitzvah of hereg, when a person has to be beheaded by Beis Din. How do you do it? So we said the Chachamim say they chop off his head with a sword, the same way as the Goyim do. And Rabbi Yehuda says it would be a degrading thing to do that, to follow in the ways of the Goyim. Instead, we use an axe and put his head on the thing over there.
That's degrading.
Well, he says that at least it's not worth following in the ways of the Goyim. But what is it? The Gemara says, because we're not learning from them. We have independently that we have Minat Torah, Halacha L'Moshe. The point is that the fact that we do it with a sword while the guy is standing, I, the Goyim, do it the same way. It doesn't matter. It's not that we learned it from them. They have their reasons for doing it. We have a lachal mishum sinai, that that's how it should be, or not a lachal mishum sinai, whatever. We have the kabbalah, that that's how it should be done. So therefore, so we didn't learn from them. So why don't we say the same thing over here? We didn't learn it from them. It's an independent thing that we came up with. So Tosfos ends up saying there are actually two different kinds of chukas agoyim. When they're doing it, when they're there's one which they're doing for the sake of Avodah Zarah. There's one where they're just doing it as a hevel and shtrud. So when it's a thing of Avodah Zarah, then you can't say we didn't learn it from them. That's the point. So Sreifa, the Gemara is asking that on the face of it. Sreifa is a thing of Avodah Zarah. So then it shouldn't matter whether we learned it from them or whether we came up with it independently. Either way, it should be also once they made it a ritual for Avodah Zarah. The same way as we say, for example, that we're not allowed to make a matseva and bring a single stone and bring korbanos on it, because even though the Obis did that, later on it became a ritual of Avodah Zarah, and therefore it's hateful to Hashem. We should say the same thing over here. As opposed to, for example, with beheading. Now, that has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. That's just a hevel and shtus of theirs. So they are fine. If we came up with it independently, then we're allowed to do it. Okay, anyway, so getting back to the Gemara. So again, how are we allowed to do the Sreifa? Now, Elo Dekula Alma Sreifa Lapopi. No, we have to answer both according to the mayor and according to the Rabbanon. Sreifa is not a chukah of Avodah Zarah. Ela Chashivusi. They just do it to demonstrate that he's an important person, that they consider him important. And therefore, b'hocha mifidis. And now, therefore, the machlokas in our Mishnah is as follows. Rav Meir sava loshna misa sheyesh b'sreifa, loshna misa she'en b'sreifa. So Rav Meir says it doesn't matter whether they do the sreifa or whether they don't do it. Either way, palchi b'alavet is b'chavim. Either way, they worship Avodah Zarah during the funeral rituals. And they, what? Palchi means they worship. So they worship Avodah Zarah as part of the funeral rituals. Therefore, it's considered a national holiday of Avodah Zarah. And therefore, we can't do business with them. But Rabbanan Savri, Mr. Shiesh Basrepa Khashivalu, that Rabbanan hold, if there's Srepa involved, then they consider this was an important king, or Palchiba, and therefore they also worship Avodah Zarah as part of the funeral rituals. The Shein Basrepa, but if they don't even bother doing the Srepa, Loy Khashiva, they obviously didn't consider this particular king, or this particular emperor, that important, Loy Palchiba, and therefore they don't worship Avodah Zarah in connection with it. And nothing to do with whether the Srefa itself is an Avodah Zarah ritual, just it shows us whether they consider it important enough to make it, whether they consider it important enough to sacrifice and whatever to their Geshkin. Okay. Gufa, getting back to what we said. We said you're allowed to burn things by the king's funeral, and there's no problem with Dachay HaMerdi with it. And we know that, Shenema, because the Pasuk says, B'sholim, that Yirmiyahu says to Tzidkiyahu, you are going to be taken captive by the king of Babel, by Nebuchadnezzar, and you're going to be blinded, etc. However, don't worry, B'sholem Thomas, eventually you'll die in peace, meaning that he got to see Nebuchadnezzar die, he got to see, not see, because he was blind, but he got to, he survived, and Nebuchadnezzar died, and he was dragged around, because people weren't sure whether he's dead yet, whatever, so Tzidkiyahu got to experience all of that, and therefore, in that sense, he died in peace. And the same kind of burning as was done for the kings, for your ancestors, the kings before you, will be done for you in Babel as well.
Sounds like a mechamata, and he saw all the punishment of his children and everything.
That's what we're saying. And after all, you'll get.
He was blind. He didn't see it.
He won't see it, but the point is, you'll get. So therefore, we see from that Srefer is a legitimate thing to do for Jewish kings. It's interesting, actually. There's a taz in Yeridea that says, as a general rule, whenever we have something that the Pasuk explicitly says is mutter, the Chachamim don't have the power to answer it. So this would be an example of that. Even if we discussed before whether it's Dauchei HaMeri or not, the Chachamim might have at some point found the need to answer it as Dauchei HaMeri, but they can't because there's an apostate that it's allowed.
That's what we're going to get to.
Just as we burn things in honor of the kings, kach sofen al nasim, so also when a nasi. Fine, but it doesn't. Divatum divakabol loyafinim means, for example, we can't make a zeta shava between chumash and nach. This isn't a zeta shava. This is just showing that it's valid. I'll be told that it's not something that's awesome. Just as we burn things by the funeral of a melech, so also we burn things by the funeral of a nasi. So what do they burn by a king's funeral? Their bed and their other personal items, because we learned in Sanhedrin that the items that a king used, nobody else is allowed to use after him. So therefore, as covered for him, they burn them. And it happened that Ram Gamliel HaZokin passed away. The Sarap of Unkelos HaGer, Shivim Manaturi. And Unkelos, the Ger, burnt in his honor 70 mana of Tzur. On the face of it, the Gemara assumes that the mana means actual, the Gemara assumes it means actual coins. And a mana tzuri is a very expensive kind of mana, because a mana is 25 sloyim, and a mana consists of 100 dinarim altogether, and we're talking about a mana tzuri, which is, the Gemara talks about in a number of places, that ketet Suri and Keset Medina. They have the kind of silver coins that were made in Sur and Tyre, which were more or less pure silver. They have the kind that were used in the Medina, that most of the time when the Gemara talks about those, it means those, which are only 1/8 silver and the rest copper. Here it's 30 monas, so it's a very, very huge amount. Yeah. But the question is, by the way, this is what we're saying, I'm going to leave Hazokin. Some of the Mephoshim, for example, Rabbi Yaakov Emdin, take out the word Hazokin because they say on the face of it, Unkelos didn't live, or at least he wasn't a ger yet, in the time of Rabbi Gamliel Hazokin. Rabbi Gamliel Hazokin passed away before the Korban Bayis Sheni. Unkelos for Pashtus lived after that. So then let me take out the word Hazokin. Maybe it was the second Rabbi Gamliel. Okay. Anyway.
Is it fair to call him Unkelos a ger, like you said, Rachavazona? You're mentioning bad things about that.
No, that's a good thing. That he became a ger.
You're not supposed to remind a ger that
he... You're not supposed to remind a ger that he didn't hear. You're not doing it as a derogatory thing. As a matter of fact, actually, now that you mention it, now that I think of it, the Medrash or the Yerushalmi or whatever, when it tells about this, it says that Unkelos said like this. Madoch, they do such things. If they do such things for the Roman emperors, who are not such honorable people necessarily, how much more so we should be doing such a thing for Rav Gamliel? So therefore, maybe the very fact that he came from that background and knew what they do for the Goyish emperor, that made him have the idea to do it for Rav Gamliel's funeral. Okay. So the question is, you just said that what they burn is their bed and their personal effects,
right.
not 70 monas. So no, it doesn't mean it was 70 monas of silver. It means it was worth 70 monas.
It's still worth money.
Still worth money, but the point is, it wasn't the actual coins that he's burning. It's not the actual coins. He's burning Rav Gamliel's bed and personal effects and whatever, which were worth a total of 70 monas.
It would make sense to burn monas.
What would
you gain from it?
Okay, well, what would you gain in general for burning things? It's in honor of the king. It's in honor of the Nazi, whatever. Okay. I mean, this is also, we have nowadays, every year they make bonfires in honor of Rashbi, right? It's a similar idea. As a matter of fact, there used to be a very common minhag that people would throw clothing and other such things into the fires, and many Rishonim and Achronim talk about that it's not a right thing to do because of Baal Pashtus. But based on our Gemara over here, maybe it depends if you're doing it for his covered. Yeah. Okay. The question is, are you telling me they don't damage or destroy anything else except for the king's personal items by his funeral? But we learn an advice. Oikrin ala malachim. Another thing we do is oikrin. Is we take the we cut the nerves or the tendons or whatever above its hooves of the horse that he rode on. We don't know yet what kind of animal it is. The Ein Bemishim Darchei HaMori, and again, there's no problem with Darchei HaMori. It's not considered a superstitious Goyish custom to do that. So we see that that's something else.
HaMori means all the Goyim or strictly the Amori?
And the reason why we call it Amori is because the Pasuk uses the expression that you shouldn't act according to the ways of Amori. It means in general, Goyim or David is on it. So Rav Papa says he was talking specifically the horse that he rode on when he was alive. So therefore, it's another one of his clay tashmish. It's another one of his personal items. Tosfos discusses over here the question, isn't there a problem of Tzar Baal HaChayim? And the answer is, because we're doing it for the covet of the king, and it's not a question about Tashchis because it's for the covet of the king, so therefore it's not Tashchis, and it's not a problem of Tzar Baal HaChayim because it's the covet of the whole Jewish people. So the covet of the whole Jewish people, which is the covet of the king, overrides the issue of Tzar Baal HaChayim, says Tosfos. So therefore you're allowed to hamstring or whatever it is you're doing to the animal, cutting its tendons, yes.
That's halacha?
That's halacha, we're saying it. Okay, what about a behemoth to hurt a lois? You're telling me you don't do that to kosher animals as well? V'hatanya, ikur sheyesh b'tzreifa. So we learn in a braisa that if you do the kind of cutting of nerves or tendons or whatever, which would make the animal trefa, then it's also because Rashi says it's because you're not allowed to cause that an animal should be trefa. You're not allowed to physically cause an animal to be trefa. Tosfa says, why ever not? Not like it's kodshim or something. So Tzar Baal HaChayim would be either way, whether you do it in one place or the other. So Tosfos explains that it means that we're talking about the problem. When we say also over here, we don't mean whether it's also to do. We mean if it was the kind of thing where it made it trefa, then it's also to eat. V'she'en bat trefa mutter. If it wasn't the kind of thing that made the animal trefa, then you're allowed afterwards to shecht it and eat it.
Even though it's
Tzar Baal HaChayim. Even though it's Tzar Baal HaChayim, as Tosfos said, the covet of the Rabbim overrides that. The Ezer Ikur Sheyesh She'en Batrefa. So how do you do Ikur without making the animal trefa? And Menasher Parteseh Minar Kubo Lamata is that you cut off the hooves below the lower leg. If you do it above the lower leg, then it'll make the animal trefa, as we were learning hold it about. So it's like getting in whatever, but if you do it on the lowest part of the leg, then it doesn't make it trefa.
Two legs?
Yeah, five, or maybe only one leg, maybe two legs, maybe four legs, I don't know. Right. The hooves of two legs, you're right. Okay. Anyway, the point is that we see that it's kosher to animals as well. On the face of it, how is a kosher to animal a personal item of the king? Lechora, it means, therefore, that we're just taking random kosher to animals and doing this in honor by the funeral. The answer is no. Tugumara Papa the Egla Hameshechas Bekara. And your Papa explains what we're talking about over here is a calf that used to pull the king's coach. So therefore, that's again Slay Tashmisha. It's again a personal item of it. So that's all we're talking about. All the things that we burn or damage or whatever by the king are things that were used personally for him. His bed, the horse he rode on, etc. Not just random things. Okay, then we said in the Mishnah, Yom Tiglachas Karmei. We said in the Mishnah that another day we said that's considered a holiday for a goy is the day that he shaves his beard. And we said Yom Tiglachas Karmei Uvlurisei, the day that he shaves his hair, his beard, and his bloitis, which a bloitis we said is some kind of growth of hair on the back of his head or in the middle of his head or whatever it is that they would do in honor of Avodah. And we talked about in the Mishnah, are we talking about ones that the emperor did it and therefore it was a national thing? Are we talking about things that an individual person did? Whatever. Anyway, but we have a more basic question. Hey, Chikatani, what does the Mishnah mean? Yom Tiglachas Kone V'Hanochas Bluri. So does it mean the day that he shaves his beard and the day that he starts growing his bloitis in honor of his Getchka? Oh, bloitis is some kind of growth of hair. Rashi describes it that it's above the nape of the neck. So like here, the Rambam understands it as more like a mohawk in the middle of the head. Whatever it is, the point is they did it in honor of Avodah Zarah. So are we talking about the day that he shaves his beard and the day that he starts growing his bloitis, where in other words he shaves the rest of his hair and leaves his bloitis? Or maybe it means the day he shaves his beard and the day when he shaves off the bloitis, again in honor of his Avodah Zarah. And Tosfos points out that both, apparently, the Gemara understands that both of those times, both when he started growing the bloitis and when he finished growing it and cut it off, both of those times he would also make a whole thing of shaving his beard. So therefore, we're not sure which one are we talking about. Toshma, the Tanya Tabayo, we can see, because we learn in a braise of both of them. Yom Tiglachas Skonei V'Hanochas Bluris, the day that he shaves his beard and starts growing his bloitis, and Yom Tiglachas Skonei V'Haboras Bluris, and the day that he shaves his beard and leaves his bloitis in order for it to grow for the next year or whatever. So both of those would be Avodah Zarah occasions for him. Omer of Yehuda Amashmol. So now, So Rabbi Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, besides all the chagas that we learned about in our Mishnah, the national ones, the personal ones, whatever, Oid Acheres Yesh Lahem Beroyim. In Rome, they have one other one that we haven't mentioned. Achaf L'Shidim Shonim, Rabbi and Adam Shalim, once every 70 years, they take a whole person, a person who is not handicapped, meaning Rashi says that represents Esav. They make him ride on the shoulders of a lame person, which represents Yaakov, who was lame after fighting with the Malach. In other words, so they put the Esav on top to represent that Esav still rules over Yaakov. They dress him in the clothes of Adam Rishon, the famous clothes that Esav had, that Rivka put on Yaakov to get the brachas. They put on his head the skin of the face of Rabbi Shmuel. We know the famous thing. Rabbi Shmuel was one of the Asar Arugi Malchus. They we have in the Piyut we say over there on Yom Kippur, in the Kinnis we say on Tisha B'Av. We mention how the Roman emperor's daughter of that time was taken in by his beauty and by his handsomeness, and she tells her father to strip off his skin so they can keep it as a souvenir of how beautiful he was. So they take that and put it on this guy's head. They hang around his neck, the pashtus, so all of this is, the pashtus means the guy on top, the one representing Esav, they hang around his neck the weight of 200 zuz of pizza. Paz is a kind of very expensive precious stone, Rashi says, which is very rare in the world, but here they managed to get together 200 zuzim of it. There's a different gear set up, there's 4 zuzim. Which, okay, 200 zuz might be a bit heavy for him to carry around his neck, so maybe 4 zuz in his... I don't know. Some kind of very precious stone. The Gemara mentions elsewhere that there's only two, that Tosfos brings over here, that there's only two, that there's only two small amounts of it in the world, one in Rome and one in the whole rest of the world. So Tosfos says over here that doesn't mean that, okay, it means a small amount, but still enough that you can have, enough that you can have two, four zuzim or 200 zuzim, whatever weight of it over here. Then what they do is they cover all of the marketplaces in Rome with inach, which is onyx or carbuncle or whatever, some kind of semi-precious stone. And they make an announcement before this procession as follows: sach kiri plaster. Sach, meaning Rashi says, means the calculation of kiri, of the master, meaning Yaakov, plaster is false. Meaning, Rashi says, like this, Yaakov had brought his children together and told them, I'm going to tell you when Mashiach comes. That calculation, they're saying, is false, because it's not going to happen. The Jewish people are not going to be redeemed. Chas v'shalom. There's different other explanations. Tosfos says, why are they calling Yaakov our master? So Tosfos says they're talking about Yitzchak. It means that Yitzchak's calculation, that he ended up giving the brachas to Yaakov, are false, because the brachas didn't come true for Yaakov. They came true for us. Rabbi Hanano has yet another explanation that Sach means the brother, so it means the brother of our master is a faker, our brother being our master being Esav, the brother being Yaakov. Achua de Morona Zayachna, the brother of our master, here for sure it refers to Yaakov, is Zayachna, is a forger. And they continue announcing, Dechomi, whoever is going to see this procession now, the Simcha, is going to see it. Udeloichomi, anybody who doesn't see it is never going to see it again, because it only happens once every 70 years, and most people don't live that long. And they continue, Mai ahane, the Ramah, Brahma Usei, Ulozayakne, Bezaifanusei. What good did it do for the cheater with his cheating and for the forger with his forgery? In other words, they're saying, what good, after all, did it do Yaakov that he tricked Esav and got the brachas, if, after all, he doesn't have them, we have them now? Umas Simon, and they finish off the announcement as Umas Simon Bahachi, and they finish off the announcement as follows. Vayladein kad yikum dein. Woe to this one when that one arises. Meaning, Rashi says, they understand that eventually there might be a time when Yaakov arises, and when he does, then they say, we know that at that point we're in trouble.
They sense it,
right.
The last sentence contradicts the whole thing.
No, well, that's actually, some of them, of course, should say that they would only say that, like they'd say that, part in a whisper, or they'd say it in a different language so that people don't understand.
They
so they knew, but still, yeah. Also, there's an interesting explanation that I saw that specifically what they're talking about is they know, which we learned in Sanhedrin, that there's two ways Mashiach can come, Achishena and Ve'ita. They agree, of course, there can be an Achishena. Fine, and they're saying, if Yaakov arises and does Tshuva, then we know we're in trouble. But as long as it's only Ve'ita, we're not worried about that. We claim that the whole Ve'ita thing is fake, because it hasn't happened yet, and therefore they claim that it's never going to happen.
And we'll make our best to prevent that.
Basically. And that's also, by the way, so why we're saying they do it once every 70 years, Mephoshim talk about, because we know the Jewish people got out of Babel after 70 years. So therefore, every 70 years, like they're saying, look at this, the Jewish people haven't gotten out of this gullus, therefore that's it, they're gone. So before we get to the next piece, actually, so the Maharal has a whole explanation, has a whole detailed explanation of what on earth are they doing with all of this. And he explains the gist of it is that the Romans are trying to say, with this whole ceremony over here, they're trying to say, look, you have Adam Rishon. You have, who is the real heir of Adam Rishon? Is it Yaakov? So we say yes. We say, for example, we live in Gemara Chalas and Bava Metzia, that Yaakov had resembled Adam Rishon. On the other hand, they say, no, Esav is the real...
Where do we see that?
I think I mentioned in Bava Metzia over there, it says that Rabba Bahu resembled Yaakov, and Yaakov resembled Adam Rishon. On the other hand, so the Romans now are claiming, no, we're the real Adam. And therefore, what do they have? They have a person, they bring out the most beautiful face, which is the skin of Rabbi Shmuel, the most beautiful clothing, which is the clothing of Adam Rishon, the most beautiful decoration, which is the paz over there. They coat the streets with Enoch over there, and this whole announcement over there is to say, you Jews think that you are the heirs of Adam, that you're really what a human being is supposed to be. No, we have accomplished what a human being is really supposed to be.
They killed 6 million Jews, and that's what they wanted to accomplish to begin with.
However, Ravashi said, after all, though, their mouth tripped them up. In this announcement that they were making, there was something that they ended up saying wrong. If they had said, the forger is the brother of our master, Kidakami, then it would mean exactly what they wanted to say, that Yaakov, the brother of our master, is the forger. Hashta, Amri, Madrona, Zayafna. Now, the, what do they say? They say the brother of our master, the forger, means they themselves realize subconsciously, Madrona Gufe Zayafu, the master himself. Esav is the real forger. Subconsciously, they realize that, and therefore they just put it in their mouth to actually say it that way. Historically, by the way, there was a whole ceremony that happened in that officially that was supposed to be in Rome. Officially, it was supposed to be every 100 years or so, but in practice, they had it a little more often than that, similar to the 70 years of Our Gemara. And they have there's historical records from one of them that took place actually in Shmuel's time, where they had a whole thing like this involving a lame person on top with a healthy person riding on top of him, et cetera, et cetera. So you have historians who claim that actually the official reasons why the Romans had that whole thing was the emperor of that time had a rival, and he's the rival is represented by the lame person, and he's represented by the healthy one, et cetera, et cetera. But the Chachamim saw the real reality behind it. They're not just doing it this time because this particular emperor has a rival. They're doing it because they realize what's going on between Yaakov and Esau. He was, but they're arguing that nevertheless he's still lame over there because
he hasn't changed.
Okay, so the question is, "V'tana didan my time like a chashivla." So why doesn't our Mishnah mention this ceremony of theirs? The answer is the Issa B'choshat of a Shata Kachoshiv. The Mishnah is only mentioning festivals of theirs that happen every year. The less of a B'choshat of a Shata like a Kachoshiv. The Mishnah is not mentioning ones that don't happen every year. And maybe Taka means that you're not also to do business with them 3 days before this. Maybe you're only also to do business with them on the day of this. Fine. Okay. Hani Diremoi. Okay, so far we've been talking about all the Roman festivals. All the ones mentioned in our Mishnah are all Chagas of the Romans. Or the Parsoimai, what are the Chagas of the Persians? And the answer is Mutardi, Vituriski, Moharniki, and Muharin. Those are their four big holidays that they had every year. You have many different Jewish stories in Kisveyad, what it is, because obviously once Jews weren't living in that area anymore, then the words easily get corrupted when you're copying them from one Kisveyad to another. So it's a little hard to tell what they are. They actually asked one of the Goinim. They asked a question to one of the Gaonim, what are these holidays? And he answered two of them, I'm not sure, because they don't even keep anymore, and he identified the other two. One of them, I think he says, is in the spring, and one, I think he says, is the beginning of the winter and of the summer. One of them, actually, Muharin, is there's a Persian festival, Adar Yom Hazeh. Nowadays they're mostly Muslims, but whatever. They have their New Year's in their language is called Nowruz. So that's based on what I have in Kisveyad, Muharin could have originally been Muharuz and originally Nowruz or whatever, so it could be that. But who knows? Hani de Parsoya Duremoi, okay, that takes care of the Persian and the Roman ones. De Bavloimai, what are the Chagas of the Babylonians? Because after all, the Gemara was written in Babel. The people over there follow the Babylon calendar, follow the Babylonian calendar, but they're ruled over by Persia. So both of them are legal holidays.
When they started the Babylon before they were ruled by Persia?
No, they started after, but the point is that you had the same way as, for example, you might have a country where the official legal holidays, let's say, are the Christian holidays, but let's say you have a big Muslim population over there, so therefore also the Muslim holidays are like alternate side parking regulations. So the same way over here, you know, you have the local goyim over there are the Babylonians, but they're the rulers of the Persians, so therefore you need to know both them. So they are Moharniki, which is the same as the Persian one, Vaknise, Vachanuni, Vesterbad. Those are therefore.
Okay.
Esav Adar, Rashi said, means the 10th of Adar. They had a festival the same way. They have July 4th, so the same way. They had a festival called the 10th of Adar. Maybe they went, but no, Abdafka, they themselves had similar name months. No, not necessarily. They themselves had similar name months. You have the famous thing that the Medrash says, Shmoy Sachadashim, Olo B'yadim B'bubble, that we got the names of our months from the Babylonians. So then, yeah, so they had a month of Adar, so yeah. So either it's Rav Chanan the son of Rav Chista, or it's Rav Chanan the son of Rava. Either way, it says in the name of Rav, Chamisha Bote Avodah Kechavim Kavurin Heim. There are five permanent places of Avodah Zarah in the sense they don't just have festivals sometimes during the year. Every day throughout the year, they're celebrating over there and bringing korban. So therefore, anybody who goes to those places, you're never allowed to do business with them. What are those five places? Elohim, Baal, the Babel, the temple of Baal in the city of Babel, Beis Nevoi, the Kursi, Parasa Shabbat Machlog, Srifa Shabbat Ashkelon, Nishra Shabbat Avia. Those are the five. Those are the permanent. In fact, no, Ashkelon and Eretz Yisrael. But the Goyim had a temple over there, yeah. He also, Rav Dimi, when Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, he reported, Ha'isifu Aleihen, and they also added, there's more that have to be added to that list, also Yerid Shabbat Bechi, Nidbacha Shabbat Akai. Those two also, Be'en Bechi, the one in Ein Bechi and one in Akai. Okay, so actually it's interesting. There's famous ruins of a famous old Goyish temple in a city called Baalbek in Syria. They have it's a major archaeological site or whatever. Could be that Baalbek is the Ein Bechi of our Gemara over here. Some people want to say that. Another version is not Nidbacha, but Nitbara in Akai. Okay, Rabdimi Minhaja Masni Ibcha, Rabdimi Minhaja flips around the designations of these places. Yurid Shabaka, the Yurid, either that Yurid sometimes means a fair, so either it was a fair, either it was like a year round fair, or it just means that was the name of the Avodah Zarah, in Akai and Nidbacha Shabain Bechi. The one in Baalbek actually is built made out of huge stones. Nidbach means a row of stones, so maybe that's why they called it Nidbach, because out of it for the huge stones that still exist. Yeah, I mean, it's in ruins now, but there's still huge parts of it that exist. Yeah. In what sense are we saying that they're permanent? Most of our Zohar temples are permanent. So Rav Chista tells him, this is what your grandfather, which is Rav, said. It means kvurin hein la'olam. It means they're permanent in the sense tadira, they're constant. Kula shata palchilu. Throughout the year, they worship these getches. Unlike many other getches, which they only have certain days designated for them, these are a year-round thing. On the other hand, Amar Shmuel, but Goyla ena also elayim edom dovad. On the other hand, Shmuel says that in the Goyla outside Eretz Yisrael, you're not also 3 days before. It's only the day of their festival is also. And actually, the Ritva says that, and Rashi mentions the reason, which we've discussed before, that, look, I mean, we live among the Goyim of necessity. We have to do a certain amount of business with them. There's also a problem of Yira, that we're afraid of them. So therefore, so the Chachamim relaxed the rules and said, only in Eretz Yisrael do you have the rules 3 days before. Outside Eretz Yisrael, it's only the day of the Chag itself. And therefore, the Ritva learns that actually Shmuel is arguing with what we just said about these five or seven or whatever places of permanent Avodah Zarah, that even then, it's not necessary. If you see a person is going to worship over there, fine, is one thing, but otherwise, not necessarily.
So, before that,
Not before Shmuel's statement. Shmuel is saying a din that he had learned from his Rebbeim, which existed before that also. We have in the name of Shmuel,
right,
because he's the one who reported it.
But before that point in the Gemara, we apply that 3 days before the...
We thought so.
Now
we say no. Yeah.
So now it's
one.
Just on the
data. Okay, the question is, so are you telling me that actually even the day of the Chaga is also to do business with them? We find that Rav Yehuda gave Rav Bruna permission to go and buy, to go and sell wine to the Goyim. Rav Gidol was a Bunei Chitin, and he gave Rav Gidol permission to go and sell wheat. The Chag Sedatayi, on the festival of the Tayi, of the Arabs. Mm-hmm. And the Arabs in those days were Avodah Zarah. This is a few hundred years before Islam. Mind you, the Ran holds that Islam is Avodah Zarah, but most of the other Rishonim disagree with that. The Ran holds that, yeah, because he says they worship by Mecca, by the stone over there. That's like miraculous. They throw rocks at a pillar nearby. That's another form of miracle. So he says they're Avodah Zarah. The vast majority of Rishonim disagree with him. Yeah. Anyway, but in this time, and during the period of the Gemara, the Arabs were Avodah Zarah. So why are you allowed to do business with them on their holiday? The answer is Shani Chag Sedatayi Delek Tviya, because different with their holidays, they're not necessarily fixed. They don't necessarily make them every year. So they're not necessarily such important events to them that therefore we're concerned that they're going to take what you sold to them and bring it as a korban to their getchka or go thank their getchka or whatever, because it's anyway not even something that they consider important enough to bother making every year. And that's the halacha, therefore. That if you have something like that, which they don't necessarily make as an annual thing, they don't give it any chashivos, then you're allowed to. Then you're allowed to. If they make it a thing of chashivos, then you're subject to what we discussed. Then, in Eretz Yisrael, 3 days. Outside of it, not. But even that, you have the whole discussion that we had at the beginning of the Masechta, and we had here and there, to what extent these didn't apply nowadays. To what extent are the goyim nowadays of Avodah Zarah? To what extent can we be master it because of Eva? To what extent can we be master it because anyway, we're not necessarily telling them something that they can use for their rituals, etc.
What about doing business with in countries they do practice avodah zarah, like India? Like
so if you have, so I guess if you have actual, well, so if, even you talk about nowadays the Christians, for example, I mean, again, the Meiri holds they're not owed avodah zarah, but most of the other Rishonim hold they are. The Rambam, for example, holds they are. So according to him, same they would be on the same dinim as the Hindus. There's no difference.
No,
of course, right. So you'd still have. So again, you might have the various other rules. We live among them, and we have to do business with them, and we're not selling them things that they're actually using, and they're not going to go rush off to their temple and go thank their deshke, etc. So therefore, maybe there can be hetairim for it. But no, as far as that goes, there's not necessarily a difference whether you're talking in Western countries versus you're talking in India or whatever.
There's a big difference. I mean,
well, there's a difference of what deshkes they worship, but it's not necessarily a difference as far as these halachas.
Are we up today?
No.
Yeah.